move cannot be obeyed. It must be rescinded before Selden solves our problem for us. Once the emergency is passed, it will be too late to conciliate and our alliance will melt away. Imber stared at Randu coldly. You realize that I am head of the Foundation Armed Forces? Have I the right to determine military policy, or have I not? Excellence, you have, but some things are inexpedient. I recognize no inexpediency. It is dangerous to allow your people separate fleets in this emergency. Divided action plays into the hands of the enemy. We must unite, Ambassador, militarily as well as politically. Randu felt his throat muscles tighten. He omitted the courtesy of the opening title. You feel safe now that Selden will speak, and you move against us. A month ago, you were soft and yielding when our ships defeated the Mule at Terrell. I might remind you, sir, that it is the Foundation fleet that has been defeated in open battle 5 times, and that the ships of the independent trading worlds have won your victories for you. Imber frowned dangerously. You are no longer welcome upon Terminus, Ambassador. Your return will be requested this evening. Furthermore, your connection with subversive democratic forces on Terminus will be, and has been, investigated. Randu replied, When I leave, our ships will go with me. I know nothing of your Democrats. I know only that your Foundation ships have surrendered to the Mule by the treason of their high officers, not their sailors, democratic or otherwise. I tell you that 20 ships of the Foundation surrendered at Horliger at the orders of their Rear Admiral when they were unharmed and unbeaten. The Rear Admiral was your own close associate. He presided at the trial of my nephew when he first arrived from Calgan. It is not the only case we know of, and our ships and men will not be risked under potential traitors. Imber said, You will be placed under guard upon leaving here. Randu walked away under the silent stares of the contemptuous coterie of the rulers of Terminus. It was 12:10. Beta and Toran had already arrived. They rose in their back seats and beckoned to Randu as he passed. Randu smiled gently. You are here after all. How did you work it? Magnifico was our politician, grinned Toran. Imber insists upon his Visi-Sonar composition based on the time vault, with himself no doubt his hero. Magnifico refused to attend without us, and there was no arguing him out of it. Ebling Miss is with us, or was. He's wandering about somewhere. Then, with a sudden access of anxious gravity, Why, what's wrong, Uncle? You don't look well. Randu nodded. I suppose not. We're in for bad times, Toran. When the Mule is disposed of, our turn will come, I'm afraid. A straight, solemn figure in white approached and greeted them with a stiff bow. Beta's dark eyes smiled as she held out her hand. Captain Pritchard, are you on space duty then? The captain took the hand and bowed lower. Nothing like it. Dr. Miz, I understand, has been instrumental in bringing me here, but it's only temporary. Back to Home Guard tomorrow. What time is it? It was 12:03. Magnifico was the picture of misery and heartsick depression. His body curled up in his eternal effort at self-effacement. His long nose was pinched at the nostrils, and his large, down-slanted eyes darted uneasily about. He clutched at Beta's hand, and when she bent down, he whispered, Do you suppose, my lady, that all these great ones were in the audience, perhaps, when I played the sonovisor? Everyone, I'm sure, Beta assured him, and shook him gently. And I'm sure they all think you're the most wonderful player in the galaxy, and that your concert was the greatest ever seen. So you just straighten yourself and sit correctly. We must have dignity. He smiled feebly at her mock frown, and unfolded his long-boned limbs slowly. It was noon, and the glass cubicle was no longer empty. It was doubtful that anyone had witnessed the appearance. It was a clean break. One moment not there, and the next moment there. In the cubicle was a figure in a wheelchair, old and shrunken, from whose wrinkled face bright eyes shone, and whose voice, as it turned out, was the liveliest thing about him. A book lay face downward in his lap, and the voice came softly. "I am Harry Seldon." He spoke through a silence, thunderous in its intensity. "I am Harry Seldon. I do not know if anyone is here at all by mere sense perception, but that is unimportant. I have few fears as yet of a breakdown in the plan. For the first 3 centuries, the percentage probability of non-deviation is 94.2. He paused to smile, and then said genially, "By the way, if any of you are standing, you may sit. If any would like to smoke, please do. I am not here in the flesh. I require no ceremony. Let us take up the problem of the moment, then. For the first time, the Foundation has been faced, or perhaps is in the last stages of facing, civil war. Till now, the attacks from without have been adequately beaten off, and inevitably so, according to the strict laws of psychohistory. The attack at present is that of a too undisciplined outer group of the Foundation against the too authoritarian central government. The procedure was necessary, the result obvious. The dignity of the high-born audience was beginning to break. Inber was half out of his chair. Beta leaned forward with troubled eyes. What was the great Seldon talking about? She had missed a few of the words. That the compromise worked out is necessary in 2 respects. The revolt of the independent traders introduces an element of new uncertainty in a government perhaps grown overconfident. The element of striving is restored. Although beaten, a healthy increase of democracy. There were raised voices now. Whispers had ascended the scale of loudness, and the edge of panic was in them. Beta said in Toran's ear, "Why doesn't he talk about the mule? The traders never revolted." Toran shrugged his shoulders. The seated figure spoke cheerfully across and through the increasing disorganization. A new and firmer coalition government was the necessary and beneficial outcome of the logical civil war forced upon the Foundation. And now only the remnants of the old empire stand in the way of further expansion. And in them, for the next few years at any rate, is no problem. Of course, I cannot reveal the nature of the next prob... In the complete uproar, Seldon's lips moved soundlessly. Ebling Miz was next to Randu, face ruddy. He was shouting, "Seldon's off his rocker! He's got the wrong crisis! Were your traitors ever planning civil war?" Randu said thinly, "We planned one, yes. We called it off in the face of the mule." "Then the mule is an added feature, unprepared for in Seldon's psychohistory. Now what's happened?" In the sudden frozen silence, Beta found the cubicle once again empty. The atomic glow of the walls was dead, the soft current of conditioned air absent. Somewhere the sound of a shrill siren was rising and falling in the scale, and Randu formed the words with his lips. "Space raid." And Ebling Miz held his wristwatch to his ears and shouted suddenly, "Stopped by the galaxy! Is there a watch in the room that is going?" His voice was a roar. 20 wrists went to 20 ears, and in far less than 20 seconds it was quite certain that none were. "Then," said Miz, with a grim and horrible finality, "something has stopped all atomic power in the time vault, and the mule is attacking." Inber's wail rose high above the noise. "Take your seats! The mule is 50 parsecs distant!" "He was," shouted back Miz, "a week ago. Right now, Terminus is being bombarded." Beta felt a deep depression settle softly upon her. She felt its folds tighten close and thick, until her breath forced its way only with pain past her tightened throat. The outer noise of a gathering crowd was evident. The doors were thrown open and a harried figure entered and spoke rapidly to Inber, who had rushed to him. "Excellence," he whispered, "not a vehicle is running in the city. Not a communication line to the outside is open. The 10th Fleet is reported defeated and the mule ships are outside the atmosphere. The General Staff..." Inber crumpled and was a collapsed figure of impotence upon the floor. In all that hall, not a voice was raised now. Even the growing crowd without was fearful, but silent, and the horror of cold panic hovered dangerously. Inber was raised. Wine was held to his lips. His lips moved before his eyes opened, and the word they formed was surrender. Beta found herself near to crying, not for sorrow or humiliation, but simply and plainly out of a vast, frightened despair. Ebling Miz plucked at her sleeve. Come, young lady. She was pulled out of her chair bodily. We're leaving, he said, and take your musician with you. The plump scientist's lips were trembling and colorless. Magnifico, said Beta faintly. The clown shrank in horror. His eyes were glassy. The mule, he shrieked. The mule is coming for me. He thrashed wildly at her touch. Taran leaned over and brought his fist up sharply. Magnifico slumped into unconsciousness, and Taran carried him out potato sack fashion. The next day, the ugly, battle-black ships of the mule poured down upon the landing fields of the planet Terminus. The attacking general sped down the empty main street of Terminus City in a foreign-made ground car that ran where a whole city of atomic cars stood useless. The proclamation of occupation was made 24 hours to the minute after Selden had appeared before the former mighty of the Foundation. Of all the Foundation planets, only the independent traders still stood, and against them the power of the mule, conqueror of the Foundation, now turned itself. Chapter 19. Start of the Search. The lonely planet, Haven, only planet of an only sun of a galactic sector that trailed raggedly off into intergalactic vacuum, was under siege. In a strict military sense, it was certainly under siege, since no area of space on the galactic side further than 20 parsecs distance was outside range of the mule's advanced bases. In the 4 months since the shattering fall of the Foundation, Haven's communications had fallen apart like a spider web under the razor's edge. The ships of Haven converged inwards upon the home world, and only Haven itself was now a fighting base. And in other respects, the siege was even closer, for the shrouds of helplessness and doom had already invaded. Beta plodded her way down the pink-waved aisle past the rows of milky plastic-topped tables and found her seat by blind reckoning. She eased onto the high, armless chair, answered half-heard greetings mechanically, rubbed a wearily itching eye with the back of a weary hand, and reached for her menu. She had time to register a violent mental reaction of distaste to the pronounced presence of various cultured fungus dishes, which were considered high delicacies at Haven, and which her Foundation taste found highly inedible. And then she was aware of the sobbing near her and looked up. Until then, her notice of Jadi, the plain, snub-nosed, indifferent blonde at the dining unit diagonally across, had been the superficial one of the non-acquaintance. And now Jadi was crying, biting woefully at a moist handkerchief and choking back sobs until her complexion was blotched with turgid red. Her shapeless radiation-proof costume was thrown back upon her shoulders, and her transparent face shield had tumbled forward into her dessert, and there remained. Beta joined the three girls who were taking turns at the eternally applied and eternally inefficacious remedies of shoulder patting, hair smoothing, and incoherent murmuring. What's the matter? She whispered. One turned to her and shrugged a discreet, I don't know. Then, feeling the inadequacy of the gesture, she pulled Beta aside. She's had a hard day, I guess, and she's worrying about her husband. Is he on space patrol? Yes. Beta reached a friendly hand out to Jadi. Why don't you go home, Jadi? Her voice was a cheerfully businesslike intrusion on the soft, flabby inanities that had preceded. Jadi looked up, half in resentment. I've been out once this week already. Then you'll be out twice. If you try to stay on, you know, you'll just be out 3 days next week. So going home now amounts to patriotism. Any of you girls work in her department? Well, then, suppose you take care of her card. Better go to the washroom first, Judy, and get the peaches and cream back where it belongs. Go ahead. Shoo. Beta returned to her seat and took up the menu again with a dismal relief. These moods were contagious. One weeping girl would have her entire department in a frenzy these nerve-torn days. She made a distasteful decision, pressed the correct buttons at her elbow, and put the menu back into its niche. The tall, dark girl opposite her was saying, "Isn't much any of us can do except cry, is there?" Her amazingly full lips scarcely moved, and Beta noticed that their ends were carefully touched to exhibit that artificial, just-so half-smile that was the current last word in sophistication. Beta investigated the insinuating thrust contained in the words with lashed eyes and welcomed the diversion of the arrival of her lunch as the tile top of her unit moved inward and the food lifted. She tore the wrappings carefully off her cutlery and handled them gingerly till they cooled. She said, "Can't you think of anything else to do, Hella?" "Oh, yes," said Hella. "I can." She flicked her cigarette with a casual and expert finger motion into the little recess provided, and the tiny atom flash caught it before it hit shallow bottom. "For instance," and Hella clasped slender, well-kept hands under her chin, "I think we could make a very nice arrangement with the mule and stop all this nonsense. But then I don't have the, facilities to manage to get out of places quickly when the mule takes over." Beta's clear forehead remained clear. Her voice was light and indifferent. "You don't happen to have a brother or husband in the fighting ships, do you?" "No. All the more credit that I see no reason for the sacrifice of the brothers and husbands of others. The sacrifice will come the more surely for surrender. The Foundation surrendered and is at peace. Our men are away and the galaxy is against us." Beta shrugged and said sweetly, "I'm afraid it is the first of the pair that bothers you." She returned to her vegetable platter and ate it with the clammy realization of the silence about her. No one in earshot had cared to answer Hella's cynicism. She left quickly after stabbing at the button which cleared her dining unit for the next shift's occupation. A new girl, three seats away, stage whispered to Hella, "Who was she?" Hella's mobile lips curled in indifference. "She's our coordinator's niece. Didn't you know that?" "Yes?" Her eyes sought out the last glimpse of disappearing back. "What's she doing here?" "Just an assembly girl. Don't you know it's fashionable to be patriotic? It's all so democratic it makes me wretch." "Now, Hella," said the plump girl to her right, "she's never pulled her uncle on us yet. Why don't you lay off?" Hella ignored her neighbor with a glazed sweep of eyes and lit another cigarette. The new girl was listening to the chatter of the bright-eyed accountant opposite. The words were coming quickly. "And she's supposed to have been in the vault, actually in the vault, you know, when Selden spoke. And they say the mayor was in frothing furies and there were riots and all that sort of thing, you know. And she got away before the mule landed, and they say she had the most thrilling escape, had to go through the blockade and all. I do wonder she doesn't write a book about it, these war books being so popular these days, you know. And she was supposed to be on this world of the mules, too. Calgan, you know, and..." The time bell shrilled, and the dining room emptied slowly. The accountant's voice buzzed on, and the new girl interrupted only with the conventional and wide-eyed, "Really?" at the appropriate points. The huge cave lights were being shielded group-wise in the gradual descent towards the darkness that meant sleep for the righteous and hard-working when Beta returned home. Taran met her at the door with a slice of buttered bread in his hand. "Where have you been?" he asked, food muffled. Then more clearly, "I've got a dinner of sorts rassled up. It isn't much. Don't blame me." But she was circling him wide-eyed. "Tori, where's your uniform? What are you doing in civvies?" "Orders, bae. Randu is holed up with Ebling Miz right now, and what it's all about, I don't know. So there you have everything." "Am I going?" She moved towards him impulsively. He kissed her before he answered. "I believe so. It'll probably be dangerous." "What isn't dangerous?" "Exactly. Oh, yes, and I've already sent for Magnifico. He's probably coming, too." "Oh, you mean his concert at the engine factory will have to be canceled?" Obviously. Beta passed into the next room and sat down to a meal that definitely bore signs of having been wrassled up. She cut the sandwiches in two with quick efficiency and said, "That's too bad about the concert. The girls at the factory were looking forward to it. Magnifico, too, for that matter. Darn it, he's such a queer thing. Stirs your mother complex, Bay, that's what he does. Someday we'll have a baby, and then you'll forget Magnifico." Beta answered from the depths of her sandwich, "Strikes me that you're all the stirring my mother complex can stand." And then she laid the sandwich down and was gravely serious in a moment. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. "That's too bad about the concert. The girls at the factory were looking forward to it. Magnifico, too, for that matter. Darn it, he's such a queer thing. Stirs your mother complex, Bay, that's what he does. Someday we'll have a baby, and then you'll forget Magnifico." Beta answered from the depths of her sandwich, "Strikes me that you're all the stirring my mother complex can stand." And then she laid the sandwich down and was gravely serious in a moment. "Tori?" "Hmm?" "Tori, I was at City Hall today, at the Bureau of Production. That is why I was so late today." "What were you doing there?" "Well," she hesitated uncertainly, "it's been building up. I was getting so I couldn't stand it at the factory. Morale just doesn't exist. The girls go on crying jags for no particular reason. Those who don't get sick become sullen. Even the little mousy types pout out. In my particular section, production isn't a quarter of what it was when I came. And there isn't a day that we have a full roster of workers." "All right," said Toran. "Tie in the B of P. What did you do there?" "Asked a few questions." "And it's so, Tori. It's so all over Haven. Dropping production, increasing sedition and disaffection." The bureau chief just shrugged his shoulders after I had sat in the anteroom an hour to see him and only got in because I was the coordinator's niece, and said it was beyond him. Frankly, I don't think he cared. Now, don't go off base, Bay. I don't think he did." She was strenuously fiery. "I tell you, there's something wrong. It's that same horrible frustration that hit me in the time vault when Selden deserted us. You felt it yourself." "Yes, I did." "Well, it's back," she continued savagely. "And we'll never be able to resist the mule. Even if we had the material, we lacked the heart, the spirit, the will. Tori, there's no use fighting." Beta had never cried in Toran's memory, and she did not cry now. Not really. But Toran laid a light hand on her shoulder and whispered, "Suppose you forget it, baby. I know what you mean. But there's nothing, yes, there's nothing we can do. Everyone says that. And we just sit and wait for the knife to come down." She returned to what was left of her sandwich and tea. Quietly, Toran was arranging the beds. It was quite dark outside. Randu, as newly appointed coordinator, in itself a wartime post, of the Confederation of Cities on Haven, had been assigned, at his own request, to an upper room, out of the window of which he could brood over the rooftops and greenery of the city. Now, in the fading of the cave lights, the city receded into the level lack of distinction of the shades. Randu did not care to meditate upon the symbolism. He said to Ebling Miz, whose clear little eyes seemed to have no further interest than the red-filled goblet in his hand, "There's a saying on Haven that when the cave lights go out, it is time for the righteous and hard-working to sleep. Do you sleep much lately?" "No. Sorry to call you so late, Miz. I like the night better somehow these days. Isn't that strange? The people on Haven condition themselves pretty strictly on the lack of light meaning sleep. Myself, too. But it's different now." "You're hiding," said Miz flatly. "You're surrounded by people in the waking period, and you feel their eyes and their hopes on you. You can't stand up under it. In the sleep period, you're free." "Do you feel it, too, then?
this miserable sense of defeat? Ebling Miz nodded slowly. I do. It's a mass psychosis, an unprintable mob panic. Galaxy Randu, what do you expect? Here you have a whole culture brought up to a blind, blubbering belief that a folk hero of the past has everything all planned out and is taking care of every little piece of their unprintable lives. The thought pattern evoked has characteristics ad religio, and you know what that means? Not a bit. Miz was not enthusiastic about the necessity of explanation. He never was. So he growled, stared at the long cigar he rolled thoughtfully between his fingers, and said, "Characterized by strong faith reactions, beliefs can't be shaken short of a major shock, in which case a fairly complete mental disruption results. Mild cases, hysteria, morbid sense of insecurity. Advanced cases, madness and suicide." Randu bit at a thumbnail. "When Selden fails us, in other words, our prop disappears, and we've been leaning upon it so long our muscles are atrophied to where we cannot stand without it. That's it. Sort of a clumsy metaphor, but that's it. And you, Ebling, what of your own muscles?" The psychologist filtered out a long draft of air through his cigar and let the smoke laze out. "Rusty, but not atrophied. My profession has resulted in just a bit of independent thinking." "And you see a way out?" "No, but there must be one. Maybe Selden made no provisions for the mule. Maybe he didn't guarantee our victory. But then neither did he guarantee defeat. He's just out of the game and we're on our own. The mule can be licked." "How?" "By the only way anyone can be licked. By attacking in strength at weakness. See here, Randu. The mule isn't a Superman. If he is finally defeated, everyone will see that for himself. It's just that he's an unknown, and the legends cluster quickly. He's supposed to be a mutant. Well, what of that? A mutant means a Superman to the ignoramuses of humanity. Nothing of the sort. It's been estimated that several million mutants are born in the galaxy every day. Of the 7 million, all but 1 or 2% can be detected only by means of microscopes and chemistry. Of the 1 or 2% macromutants, that is, those with mutations detectable to the naked eye or naked mind, all but 1 or 2% are freaks, fit for the amusement centers, the laboratories, and death. Of the few macromutants whose differences are to the good, almost all are harmless curiosities, unusual in some single respect, normal and often subnormal in most others. You see that, Randu? I do, but what of the mule? Well, supposing the mule to be a mutant, then. We can assume that he has some attribute, undoubtedly mental, which can be used to conquer worlds. In other respects, he undoubtedly has shortcomings which we must locate. He would not be so secretive, so shy of others' eyes, if these shortcomings were not apparent and fatal. If he's a mutant. Is there an alternative? There might be. Evidence for mutation rests on Captain Han Pritcher of what used to be Foundation's intelligence. He drew his conclusions from the feeble memories of those who claim to know the mule, or somebody who might have been the mule, in infancy and early childhood. Pritcher worked on slim pickings there, and what evidence he found might easily have been planted by the mule for his own purposes. For it's certain that the mule has been vastly aided by his reputation as a mutant Superman. This is interesting. How long have you thought that? I never thought that, in the sense of believing it. It's merely an alternative to be considered. For instance, Randu, suppose the mule has discovered a form of radiation capable of depressing mental energy, just as he is in possession of one which depresses atomic reactions. What then? Could that explain what's hitting us now, and what hit the Foundation? Randu seemed immersed in a near-wordless gloom. He said, "What of your own researches on the mule's clown?" And now Ebling Miz hesitated. "Useless as yet. I spoke bravely to the mayor previous to the Foundation's collapse, mainly to keep his courage up, partly to keep up my own as well. But Randu, if my mathematical tools were up to it, Then from the clown alone, I could analyze the mule completely. Then we would have him. Then we could solve the queer anomalies that have impressed me already. Such as, think, man. The mule defeated the navies of the Foundation at will, but he has not once managed to force the much weaker fleets of the independent traders to retreat in open combat. The Foundation fell at a blow. The independent traders hold out against all his strength. He first used his extinguishing field upon the atomic weapons of the independent traders of Minimon. The element of surprise lost them that battle, but they countered the field. He was never able to use it successfully against the independents again. But over and over again, it worked against Foundation forces. It worked on the Foundation itself. Why? With our present knowledge, it's all illogical. So there must be factors of which we are not aware. Treachery? That's rattle-pated nonsense, Randu. Unprintable twaddle. There wasn't a man on the Foundation who wasn't sure of victory, who would betray a certain-to-win side. Randu stepped to the curved window and stared unseeingly out into the unseeable. He said, "But we're certain to lose now. If the mule had 1,000 weaknesses, if he were a network of holes." He did not turn. It was as if the slump of his back, the nervous groping for another of the hands behind him that spoke. He said, "We escaped easily after the Time Vault episode, Ebling. Others might have escaped as well. A few did. Most did not. The extinguishing field could have been counteracted. It asked ingenuity and a certain amount of labor. All the ships of the Foundation Navy could have flown to Haven or other nearby planets to continue to fight as we did. Not 1% did so. In effect, they deserted to the enemy. The Foundation Underground, upon which most people here seem to rely so heavily, has thus far done nothing of consequence. The mule has been politic enough to promise to safeguard the property and profits of the great traders, and they have gone over to him." Ebling Miz said stubbornly, "The plutocrats have always been against us. They always held the power, too. Listen, Ebling. We have reason to believe that the mule or his tools have already been in contact with powerful men among the independent traders. At least 10 of the 27 trading worlds are known to have gone over to the mule. Perhaps 10 more waver. There are personalities on Haven itself who would not be unhappy over the mule's domination. It's apparently an insurmountable temptation to give up endangered political power, if that will maintain your hold over economic affairs. You don't think Haven can fight the mule? I don't think Haven will." And now Randu turned his troubled face full upon the psychologist. "I think Haven is waiting to surrender. It's what I called you here to tell you. I want you to leave Haven." Ebling Miz puffed up his plump cheeks in amazement. "Already?" Randu felt horribly tired. "Ebling, you are the Foundation's greatest psychologist. The real master psychologists went out with Selden, but you're the best we have. You're our only chance of defeating the mule. You can't do that here. You'll have to go to what's left of the Empire."
"To Trantor?"
"That's right. What was once the Empire is bare bones today. But something must still be at the center. They've got the records there, Ebling. You may learn more of mathematical psychology. Perhaps enough to be able to interpret the clown's mind. He will go with you, of course." Miz responded dryly, "I doubt if he'd be willing to, even for fear of the mule, unless your niece went with him." "I know that. Taran and Beta are leaving with you for that very reason. And Ebling, there's another greater purpose. Harry Selden founded 2 foundations 3 centuries ago, one at each end of the galaxy. You must find that second foundation." Chapter 20, Conspirator. The mayor's palace, what was once the mayor's palace, was a looming smudge in the darkness.
The city was quiet under its conquest and curfew, and the hazy milk of the great galactic lens, with here and there a lonely star, dominated the sky of the Foundation. In 3 centuries, the Foundation had grown from a private project of a small group of scientists to a tentacular trade empire sprawling deep into the galaxy, and half a year had flung it from its heights to the status of another conquered province. Captain Han Pritchard refused to grasp that. The city's sullen nighttime quiet, the darkened palace, intruder-occupied, were symbolic enough. But Captain Han Pritchard, just within the outer gate of the palace, with the tiny atomic bomb under his tongue, refused to understand. A shape drifted closer. The captain bent his head. The whisper came deathly low.
The alarm system is as it always was, Captain. Proceed. It will register nothing.
Softly, the captain ducked through the low archway and down the fountain-lined path to what had been Inber's garden. 4 months ago had been the day in the time vault, the fullness of which his memory balked at. Singly and separately, the impressions would come back, unwelcome, mostly at night. Old Selden speaking his benevolent words that were so shatteringly wrong, the jumbled confusion, Inber with his mayoral costume incongruously bright about his pinched, unconscious face, the frightened crowds gathering quickly, waiting noiselessly for the inevitable word of surrender, the young man, Toran, disappearing out of a side door with the mule's clown dangling over his shoulder, and himself, somehow out of it all afterward, with his car unworkable. Shouldering his way along and through the leaderless mob that was already leaving the city, destination unknown, making blindly for the various rat holes which were, which had once been, the headquarters for a democratic underground that for 80 years had been failing and dwindling. And the rat holes were empty. The next day, black alien ships were momentarily visible in the sky, sinking gently into the clustered buildings of the nearby city. Captain Han Pritchard felt an accumulation of helplessness and despair drown him. He started his travels in earnest. In 30 days, he had covered nearly 200 miles on foot, changed to the clothing of a worker in the hydroponic factories, whose body he found newly dead by the side of the road, grown a fierce beard of russet intensity, and found what was left of the underground. The city was Newton, the district a residential one of one-time elegance, slowly edging toward squalor, the house an undistinguished member of a row, and the man a small-eyed, big-boned, whose knotted fists bulged through his pockets, and whose wiry body remained unbudgingly in the narrow door opening. The captain mumbled, "I come from Miran." The man returned the gambit grimly. "Miran is early this year," the captain said. "No earlier than last year." But the man did not step aside. He said, "Who are you? Aren't you Fox? Do you always answer by asking?" The captain took an imperceptibly longer breath and then said calmly, "I am Han Pritchard, captain of the fleet and member of the Democratic Underground Party. Will you let me in?" The Fox stepped aside. He said, "My real name is Aurum Pally." He held out his hand. The captain took it. The room was well kept, but not lavish. In one corner stood a decorative book film projector, which to the captain's military eyes might easily have been a camouflaged blaster of respectable caliber. The projecting lens covered the doorway, and such could be remotely controlled. The Fox followed his bearded guest's eyes and smiled tightly. He said, "Yes, but in the days of Inber and his lackey-hearted vampires, it wouldn't do much against the mule, huh? Nothing would help against the mule. Are you hungry?" The captain's jaw muscles tightened beneath his beard, and he nodded. "It'll take a minute if you don't mind waiting." The Fox removed cans from a cupboard and placed 2 before Captain Pritchard. "Keep your finger on it and break them when they're hot enough. My heat control unit's out of whack. Things like that remind you there's a war on. Or was on, huh?" His quick words had a jovial content, but were said in anything but a jovial tone, and his eyes were coldly thoughtful. He sat down opposite the captain and said,
There'll be nothing but a burnt spot left where you're sitting if there's anything about you I don't like. Know that?
The captain did not answer. The cans before him opened at a pressure. The fox said shortly, "Stew. Sorry, but the food situation is short."
"I know," said the captain.
He ate quickly, not looking up. The fox said,
"I once saw you. I'm trying to remember, and the beard is definitely out of the picture. I haven't shaved in 30 days.
Then fiercely,
"What do you want? I had the correct passwords. I have identification."
The other waved a hand.
"Oh, I'll grant you Pritchard, all right. But there are plenty who have the passports and the identifications and the identities who are with the mule. Ever hear of Levois, huh?"
"Yes."
"He's with the mule."
"What?
Yes. He was the man they called No Surrender."
The fox's lips made laughing motions with neither sound nor humor.
"Then there's Willig with the mule. Gary and Noth with the mule. Why not Pritchard as well, huh? How would I know?"
The captain merely shook his head.
"But it doesn't matter," said the fox softly. "They must have my name if Noth has gone over. So if you're legitimate, you're in more new danger than I am over our acquaintanceship."
The captain had finished eating. He leaned back.
"If you have no organization here, where can I find one? The Foundation may have surrendered, but I haven't."
"So?
You can't wander forever, Captain. Men of the Foundation must have travel permits to move from town to town these days. You know that? Also identity cards. You have one? Also, all officers of the old Navy have been requested to report to the nearest occupation headquarters. That's you, huh?"
"Yes."
The captain's voice was hard.
"Do you think I run through fear? I was on Calgan not long after its fall to the mule. Within a month, not one of the old warlord's officers was at large, because they were the natural military leaders of any revolt. It's always been the underground's knowledge that no revolution can be successful without the control of at least part of the Navy. The mule evidently knows it, too."
The fox nodded thoughtfully.
"Logical enough. The mule is thorough. I discarded the uniform as soon as I could. I grew the beard. Afterwards, there may be some chance that others have taken the same action."
"Are you married?"
"My wife is dead. I have no children."
"You're hostage immune, then?"
"Yes."
"You want my advice? If you have any?"
"I don't know what the mule's policy is or what he intends, but skilled workers have not been harmed so far. Pay rates have gone up. Production of all sorts of atomic weapons is booming."
"Yes? Sounds like a continuing offensive."
"I don't know. The mule's a stubborn son of a drab, and he may merely be soothing the workers into submission. If Selden couldn't figure him out with all his psychohistory, I'm not going to try. But you're wearing work clothes. That suggests something, huh?"
"I'm not a skilled worker."
"You've had a military course in atomics, haven't you?"
"Certainly."
"That's enough. The Atomfield Bearings Incorporated is located here in town. Tell them you've had experience."
"The stinkers who used to run the factory for Inver are still running it. For the mule."
"They won't ask questions, as long as they need more workers to make their fat hunk. They'll give you an identity card, and you can apply for a room in the corporation's housing district. You might start now."
In that manner, Captain Han Pritchard of the National Fleet became Shield Man Lo Morrow of the 45 shop of Atomfield Bearings Incorporated. And from an intelligence agent, he descended the social scale to conspirator, a calling which led him months later to what had been Inver's private garden. In the garden, Captain Pritchard consulted the radometer in the palm of his hand. The inner warning field was still in operation, and he waited. Half an hour remained to the life of the atomic bomb in his mouth. He rolled it gingerly with his tongue. The radometer died into an ominous darkness, and the captain advanced quickly. So far, matters had progressed well. He reflected objectively that the life of the atomic bomb was his as well, that its death was his death, and the mule's death. And the grand climacteric of a 4 months private war would be reached, a war that had passed from flight through a Newton factory
For 2 months, Captain Pritcher wore leaden aprons and heavy face shields, till all things military had been frictioned off his outer bearing. He was a laborer who collected his pay, spent his evenings in town, and never discussed politics. For 2 months, he did not see the Fox. And then one day, a man stumbled past his bench, and there was a scrap of paper in his pocket. The word Fox was on it. He tossed it into the atom chamber, where it vanished in a sightless puff, sending the energy output up a millimicrovolt, and turned back to his work. That night, he was at the Fox's home, and took a hand in a game of cards with two other men he knew by reputation and one by name and face. Over the cards and the passing and repassing tokens, they spoke. The captain said, "It's a fundamental error. You live in the exploded past. For 80 years, our organization has been waiting for the correct historical moment. We've been blinded by Selden's psychohistory, one of the first propositions of which is that the individual does not count, does not make history, and that complex social and economic factors override him, make a puppet out of him." He adjusted his cards carefully, appraised their value, and said, as he put out a token, "Why not kill the mule?" "Well, now, and what good would that do?" demanded the man at his left, fiercely. "You see," said the captain, discarding two cards, "that's the attitude. What is one man out of trillions? The galaxy won't stop rotating because one man dies, but the mule is not a man. He is a mutant. Already, he had upset Selden's plan. And if you'll stop to analyze the implications, it means that he, one man, one mutant, upset all of Selden's psychohistory. If he had never lived, the foundation would not have fallen. If he ceased living, it would not remain fallen. Come, the Democrats have fought the mayors and the traitors for 80 years by connivory. Let's try assassination." "How?" interposed the Fox, with cold common sense. The captain said slowly, "I've spent 3 months of thought on that with no solution. I came here and had it in 5 minutes." He glanced briefly at the man whose broad, pink melon of a face smiled from the place at his right. "You were once Mayor Inver's Chamberlain. I did not know you were of the underground. Nor I that you were. Well then, in your capacity as Chamberlain, you periodically checked the working of the alarm system of the palace." "I did." "And the mule occupies the palace now. And so it has been announced, though he is a modest conqueror who makes no speeches, proclamations, nor public appearances of any sort. That's an old story and affects nothing. You, my ex-chamberlain, are all we need." The cards were shown, and the Fox collected the stakes. Slowly, he dealt a new hand. The man who had once been chamberlain picked up his card singly. "Sorry, Captain. I checked the alarm system, but it was routine. I know nothing about it. I expected that. But your mind carries an eidetic memory of the controls, if it can be probed deeply enough, with a psychic probe." The chamberlain's ruddy face paled suddenly and sagged. The cards in his hands crumpled under sudden fist pressure. "A psychic probe?" "You needn't worry," said the captain sharply. "I know how to use one. It will not harm you past a few days' weakness. And if it did, it is the chance you take and the price you pay. There are some among us, no doubt, who from the controls of the alarm could determine the wavelength combinations. There are some among us who could manufacture a small bomb under time control, and I myself will carry it to the mule." The men gathered over the table. The captain continued, "On a given evening, a riot will start in Terminus City, in the neighborhood of the palace. No real fighting. Disturbance, then flight. As long as the palace guard is attracted, or at the very least, distracted." From that day, for a month, the preparations went on, and Captain Han Pritcher of the National Fleet, having become conspirator, descended further in the social scale and became an assassin. Captain Pritcher, assassin, was in the palace itself and found himself grimly pleased with his psychology. A thorough alarm system outside meant few guards within. In this case, it meant none at all.
The floor plan was clear in his mind. He was a blob moving noiselessly up the well-carpeted ramp. At its head, he flattened against the wall and waited. The small closed door of a private room was before him. Behind that door must be the mutant who had beaten the unbeatable. He was early. The bomb had 10 minutes of life in it. 5 of these passed, and still in all the world there was no sound. The mule had 5 minutes to live. So had Captain Pritcher. He stepped forward on sudden impulse. The plot could no longer fail. When the bomb went, the palace would go with it. All the palace. A door between, 10 yards between, was nothing. But he wanted to see the mule as they died together. In a last insolent gesture, he thundered upon the door, and it opened and let out the blinding light. Captain Pritchard staggered, then caught himself. The solemn man, standing in the center of the small room before a suspended fishbowl, looked up mildly. His uniform was a somber black, and as he tapped the bowl in an absent gesture, it bobbed quickly, and the feather-finned orange and vermilion fish within darted wildly. He said, "Come in, Captain." To the captain's quivering tongue, the little metal globe beneath was swelling ominously, a physical impossibility, the captain knew, but it was in its last minute of life. The uniformed man said, "You had better spit out the foolish pellet and free yourself for speech. It won't blast." This book is continued on cassette number 7. The uniformed man said, "You had better spit out the foolish pellet and free yourself for speech. It won't blast." The minute passed, and with a slow, sodden motion, the captain bent his head and dropped the silvery globe into his palm. With a furious force, it was flung against the wall. It rebounded with a tiny, sharp clangor, gleaming harmlessly as it flew. The uniformed man shrugged. "So much for that, then. It would have done you no good in any case, Captain. I am not the mule. You will have to be satisfied with his viceroy." "How did you know?" muttered the captain thickly. "Blame it on an efficient counter-espionage system. I can name every member of your little gang, every step of their planning." "And you let it go this far?" "Why not? It has been one of my great purposes here to find you and some others, particularly you. I might have had you some months ago, while you were still a worker at the Newton Bearings Works, but this is much better. If you hadn't suggested the main outlines of the plot yourself, one of my own men would have advanced something of much the same sort for you. The result is quite dramatic and rather grimly humorous." The captain's eyes were hard. "I find it so, too. Is it all over now?" "Just begun. Come, Captain, sit down. Let us leave heroics for the fools who are impressed by it. Captain, you are a capable man. According to the information I have, you were the first on the Foundation to recognize the power of the mule. Since then, you have interested yourself, rather daringly, in the mule's early life. You have been one of those who carried off his clown, who incidentally has not yet been found and for which there will yet be full payment. Naturally, your ability is recognized, and the mule is not of those who fear the ability of his enemies as long as he can convert it into the ability of a new friend. Is that what you're hedging up to?" "Oh, no." "Oh, yes. It was the purpose of tonight's comedy. You are an intelligent man, yet your little conspiracies against the mule fail humorously. You can scarcely dignify it with the name of conspiracy. Is it part of your military training to waste ships in hopeless actions?" "One must first admit them to be hopeless." "One will," the viceroy assured him gently. "The mule has conquered the Foundation. It is rapidly being turned into an arsenal for accomplishment of his greater aims." "What greater aims?" "The conquest of the entire galaxy. The reunion of all the torn worlds into a new empire. The fulfillment, you dull-witted patriot, of your own Selden's dream 700 years before he hoped to see it. And in the fulfillment, you can help us." "I can, undoubtedly." "But I won't, undoubtedly." "I understand," reasoned the viceroy, "that only 3 of the independent trading worlds yet resist. They will not last much longer. It will be the last of all Foundation forces. You still hold out? Yes. Yet you won't. A voluntary recruit is the most efficient, but the other kind will do. Unfortunately, the mule is absent. He leads the fight, as always, against the resisting traitors. But he is in continual contact with us. You will not have long to wait. For what? For your conversion. The mule, said the captain frigidly, will find that beyond his ability. But he won't. I was not beyond it. You don't recognize me? Come, you were on Kalgan, so you have seen me. I wore a monocle, a fur-lined scarlet robe, a high-crowned hat. The captain stiffened in dismay. You were the warlord of Kalgan. Yes. And now I am the loyal viceroy of the mule. You see, he is persuasive. Chapter 21. Interlude in Space. The blockade was run successfully. In the vast volume of space, not all the navies ever in existence could keep their watch in tight proximity, given a single ship, a skillful pilot, and a moderate degree of luck, and there are holes, and to spare. With cold-eyed calm, Toran drove a protesting vessel from the vicinity of one star to that of another. If the neighborhood of great mass made an interstellar jump erratic and difficult, it also made the enemy detection devices useless, or nearly so. And once the girdle of ships had been passed, the inner sphere of dead space, through whose blockaded sub-ether no message could be driven, was passed as well. For the first time in over 3 months, Toran felt unisolated. A week passed before the enemy news programs dealt with anything more than the dull, self-laudatory details of growing control over the Foundation. It was a week in which Toran's armored trading ship fleeted in from the periphery with hasty jumps. Ebling Miss called out to the pilot room, and Toran rose blink-eyed from his charts. What's the matter? Toran stepped down into the small central chamber, which Beta had inevitably devised into a living room. Miz shook his head. Scuppered if I know. The mule's newsmen are announcing a special bulletin. Thought you might want to get in on it. Might as well. Where's Beta? Setting the table in the diner and picking out a menu, or some such frippery. Toran sat down upon the cot that served as Magnifico's bed, and waited. The propaganda routine of the mule's special bulletins were monotonously similar. First the martial music, and then the buttery slickness of the announcer. The minor news items would come, following one another in patient lockstep. Then the pause. Then the trumpets and the rising excitement and the climax. Toran endured it. Miz muttered to himself. The newscaster spilled out, in conventional war correspondent phraseology, the unctuous words that translated into sound the molten metal and blasted flesh of a battle in space. Rapid cruiser squadrons under Lieutenant General Salmon hit back hard today at the task force striking out from Is. The carefully expressionless face of the speaker upon the screen faded into the blackness of a space, cut through by the quick swaths of ships, reeling across emptiness in deadly battle. The voice continued through the soundless thunder. The most striking action of the battle was the subsidiary combat of the heavy cruiser Cluster against 3 enemy ships of the Nova class. The screen's view veered and closed in. A great ship sparked, and in one of the frantic attacks glowed angrily, twisted out of focus, swung back and rammed. The Cluster bowed wildly and survived the glancing blow that drove the attacker off in twisting reflection. The newsman's smooth, unimpassioned delivery continued to the last blow and the last hulk. Then a pause, and a largely similar voice and picture of the fight off Manimon, to which the novelty was added of a lengthy description of a hit-and-run landing, the picture of a blasted city, huddled and weary prisoners, and off again. Manimon had not long to live. The pause again, and this time the raucous sound of the expected brasses. The screen faded into the long, impressively soldier-lined corridor, up which the government spokesman in counselor's uniform strode quickly. The silence was oppressive. The voice that came at last was solemn, slow, and hard. By order of our sovereign, it is announced that the planet Haven, hitherto in warlike opposition to his will, has submitted to the acceptance of defeat. At this moment, the forces of our sovereign are occupying the planet. Opposition was scattered, uncoordinated, and speedily crushed. The scene faded out. The original newsman returned to